time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for March 30th, 2019. Wow, March is over. So first up this week is the conversation I promised you with Red Kite Prayer's Patrick Brady about the judging process at NABS. It's just not that simple. Go around the show, ooh and ah about a bike, and give it a blue ribbon. In fact, along with frame builder Tom Kellogg and journalist Nick Legan, Patrick has his work cut out for him with a multitude of categories, a show floor full of gorgeous bikes, and a lot of folks hoping to garner one of the top awards. After we speak with Patrick, we'll break for a station ID, and then we're going to talk with Molly Herford, who's often a guest on The Outspoken Cyclist. Molly just released an article on the 29th titled, Why Sleep is Critical for Athletes. With lengthening daylight hours, the recent time change back to daylight savings time, and the outrageous work schedules that many of us keep, it's a wonder that sleep even gets on our day-to-day calendar. But when you take all of those things and add intense athletic endeavor, lack of sleep is a recipe for disaster. After we speak with Molly, we'll take another short break, and then it's off to the Granite State, New Hampshire, for a talk with husband and wife team David and Emily Lafferty. Their company, Cycle Chinook, offers custom titanium tandems. They've built bikes for several blind stokers, including the first Ram blind tandem team. It's all about your fit, your ride preferences, and where you want to go. They also have a really cute How They Met story. So first, it's off to California for my conversation with Red Kite Prayer's Patrick Brady. Hi, Patrick. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. How are you today? Thanks for joining me.
I'm doing well, Diane. How about yourself?
Well, you know, it's spring, allegedly, here in Northeast Ohio. I'm great. I'm great. All right. Well, we're going to talk about NABS. Another show is in the books. And we were chatting before we went on air, Mr. Chief Judge. And you were telling me a little bit about the quality of the show this year.
It was, you know, we love to turn that phrase embarrassment of riches. And this show was really an outstanding example of that. In my mind, thinking back on previous years, the first time the show was in Sacramento, 2012, was truly an embarrassment of riches. Just so many really outstanding bikes from outstanding builders. And this year was really very much the same. We had, you know, an incredible cross-section of bikes, and there were builders who came who we've never seen before. Seven Cycles was there for the first time. And so the overall quality was just incredible.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about what you are tasked to do. You are the chief judge, the head judge, and it's really kind of a difficult job when you think about all the categories and all of the choices that you have to make. I mean, I've been there watching you sort of, you know, sit in the bar with your head hanging down going, oh, this is hard. This is really hard. So tell us what the judging is, what you have to do, what you are tasked with from Don Walker.
So my job, first and foremost, you know, I work with two other judges to determine which bikes are deserving of recognition. Fundamentally, that's the job of judging. My job as chief judge, to differentiate that from the task of the other two judges, Nick Legan and Tom Kellogg, is that I really handle the management of the awards in terms of working with Don on which categories we're going to have. We have on occasion added categories or deleted categories. So I'm involved in that. I crafted the builder information sheet so that when someone drops off a bike, we have some idea of what it is we're looking at beyond just staring at a really gorgeous bike. there are things that we definitely want to know about that. And then there's, you know, scheduling how each of the categories goes, what that schedule of bikes arriving and leaving is. And finally, when it comes time to award the bikes, I'm the guy who stands up on stage with Don and talks about why one bike got a nod versus another bike. Nick doesn't want to have anything to do with being up on stage, and I called Tom up on occasion to help out there because of his incredible depth of knowledge. So there's a lot of different aspects to it, but fundamentally, I'm just an opinion like Tom Kellogg and Nick Ligon. I really try to stress to people that I don't have veto power. You know, I don't have the ability to determine, you know, this is the bike. I am one vote of three.
Interesting. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Patrick Brady. He's Mr. Red Kite Prayer. Just got back from 15th annual NABS. Some interesting judging this year. You mentioned Seven Cycles, who has been a partner with Brian and me for many, many, many years. And they won two awards, like right out of the box, which is kind of cool. And I want to get to that. So I wanted to ask you a question about what some of the criteria are for a winner. Pick a category. Let's pick best road bike, since that's what I think most of my listeners ride road bikes.
Sure. So best road bike, you know, we want to see a couple different things. Naturally, the bike needs to be available custom in terms of both geometry and sizing. You know, there are certainly bikes out there where you can get custom sizing, but the geometry is the geometry. You know, anything kind of plus or minus about a centimeter of top tube length is going to have the same trail, same bottom bracket drop. It's pretty much the same overall wheelbase. What we want to see is a full custom offering. And generally, that's not an issue. Almost everything that gets submitted, you have the ability to work with the builder. If you want to recreate the feel of that 1973 Colnago or that 1986 Eddie Merckx, you know, a lot of guys out there have the ability to do that. They understand those bikes. We want to see real attention to detail. We want to see an intelligent parts pick. We want to see cable routing that looks smart. Every now and then we've run across a bike where it's got disc brakes and the hydraulic hose for the rear brake was routed through the frame, but comes out at a completely weird angle and there's no reinforcing on the exit. And so you know that in 6 months to a year, the vibration of riding on the road is going to cause the titanium or steel to start cutting into that hydraulic housing. Things like that, that, you know, we're concerned for the longevity of the bike. Those are things that can cause us to pull a bike from contention or consideration. A lot of times when all the bikes are assembled in our judging paddock, our first pass will be to look at 6 or 8 or 10 bikes that we know just aren't going to get very far. They've got a rudimentary paint job, or they're running 21 millimeter tires, which nobody really rides anymore, except for maybe on the track. And so we don't really want to kill a bike for any one small thing. But by the time a bike makes it to the group of three finalists, at every turn on that bike, you can see another detail where you go, ooh, that was really smart. Yeah, I'd love to have a bike that did that. Ooh, gosh, look at that finish. Ooh, that's my favorite curve of bar. And while we don't want to only acknowledge our own personal preferences, we tend to think that a lot of our preferences are, shall we say, intelligently selected. And so we want to see what makes sense to us, I guess is the best way to put it.
Sure. So you brought up paint. And of course, paint can make a bike or break a bike. But no pun intended, we're not breaking the bike with the paint. Titanium unpainted versus painted, do they compete in the same category? And if they do, how does that work in the judging aspect?
For best finish, if you've got a bike that you think is pretty and you are an exhibitor at the show, then you can enter one of your bikes for best finish. And anything is up for grabs. I mean, you know, I believe we had a couple of bikes from Squid in there that were rattle can sprayed. and they were neat. They were, you know, they were interesting bikes. Our finalists, let's see. One of the bikes was painted and painted using a really unusual technique. This builder, Eo Klin, who also goes by Mark for all of us in the West. Right. He's in Taipei, Taiwan, and he painted a bike with, it was multiple colors, but there was a kind of gold bronze somewhere in there. I'm not exactly sure what the most proper name for the color was, but somewhere between gold and bronze. And he sprayed it on really thick. And then before it was completely dry, he took a wire brush and made brush strokes through the paint. And then there were coat upon coat upon coat of clear coat so that he could smooth out that finish and get that really deep, rich look. It was remarkable.
Sounds really cool.
I have not seen many bikes in that direction. There was a gold leaf bike that Rudy from Black Magic did a couple of years ago that was, you know, similarly remarkable. Let's see, we had a bike from number 22 that was a finalist, and that was a titanium bike with carbon fork and titanium fenders. Most of the finish was anodization, and there was this amazing fade from a yellow on into a purple, and that was done over the fenders. There were some graphic design elements to what they were doing with the anodization, and then there was paint on the integrated bar and stem as well as the fork, and they brought all of those elements together so that the bike had a seamless appearance, despite the fact that, you know, they were working in two different media, paint and anodization. That bike took my breath away. And for my part, at a point that we might otherwise have shut down conversation, I wanted to keep talking about it because I really struggled with whether Eo Klin or number 22 should win best finish. So we're happy to consider, you know, one bike alongside another, no matter what they are finished in.
One of the interesting categories, and for those who haven't seen any of the Instagram or other social media stuff, you'll be able to see all of Patrick and Tom's and Nick's picks up on the NAB site, nahbs.com, if you're interested. But one of the interesting categories, and I think it's one that everybody is always interested in, is the new builder category, the best new builder bike. Tell us about who won this year. It was Porter. And
yes.
What about the bike put it over the top? Because I know Brian looks at his stuff. He's been following him, I think, on Instagram.
He's one of those classic enfant terrible. He came out of nowhere. I've never heard of this guy before. Had he been an exhibitor out in the rest of the hall, someone established, not there, you know, in the new builder row, I wouldn't have batted an eye. I wouldn't have guessed for a second that he hadn't been doing this very long. The bike that really put him over the top, you know, he was showing two different bikes. One was unpainted, so a classic show your work sort of thing. And it was clear that his brazing was good, you know, was solid. But the bike that, you know, really got the attention and won him the award outright was, it was a road bike with lugs that he cut by hand, and the lugs were carved to reflect Art Deco design. So the seat lug, head lug, head tube, down tube, and even a rack that he did on the front. There were all sorts of different elements on the bike. There was a chain guard. Oh my gosh, the chain guard. this guy, and it's so funny because he told me that he really didn't know what Art Deco design was until someone looked at his work and said, oh, you're really into Art Deco. And he's like, Art Deco? What's Art Deco?
He had to look it up, right?
Exactly. And he's like, oh, yeah. Well, he lives in Brooklyn. I mean, he's been in this complete immersion of Art Deco design for his whole flipping life. He's been surrounded by it. And so it's running through his bloodstream at this point. The carving on the lugs was exquisite. And I mean, in terms of original lug work, in terms of, you know, what the shaping of the lugs was and what sort of statement that makes, the most original bike at the show.
That's cool.
Seriously.
At the show, not just as a new builder.
No,
that's a pretty big statement.
Yeah, well, Mark DiNucci won for best lug work. Okay,
yeah.
You know, Mark works in fairly classic points. He thins the lugs in a way that, you know, no one else really does. There are other people who do lug thinning, but his work is, you know, on a par that few others can reach. But we've seen a lot of work like Mark's from Mark and from other people. I've seen exactly one other lugged bike where the lugs were carved in a way that evoked Art Deco design. One other bike in my life. And I tell you that Porter's bike was better.
Nice. Nice. Mm-hmm. Well, you know,
blown away.
Having that ribbon, that best new bike builder ribbon, puts this guy on the map. So he better watch out, right?
Oh, you know, I mean, he deserves to be on the map. Now.
Sure.
He did
the absolutely.
Work.
Absolutely.
You know, if I had a warehouse and unlimited funds, I'd have sent him a deposit myself. I would love to have a townie, you know, with a chain guard and the sorts of stuff that he can do.
Sure.
Total Art Deco homage in a bike. I'd love that. That would be awesome.
What do you mean? You can't do that? Never mind.
Well, I work in the bike biz.
Yeah, no kidding. But yep. Anyway, I wanted to ask you about the best in show. You mentioned number 22 bicycles. What was the bike best in show and why? What made it the best in show?
So it was the bike that they had submitted for both best finish and best road bike. And, you know, I don't know that anybody ever gets excited about having fenders on their bike. Sometimes you find a bike and it's got fenders that have been painted to match the rest of the bike. And you think, oh, that's pretty nice. But I can't recall an occasion in history where the fenders really made the bike, really augmented the appearance of the bike in a way that the bike simply would not have been cool without the fenders. This bike was clearly that. The anodized fade on the fenders was exquisite. The shaping of the fenders themselves was also exquisite. The radius of the bend matched the wheel size perfectly and tire size. One of the things that we ran into an awful lot with gravel bikes was that people would put fenders on them and either they wouldn't have enough clearance or the radius wasn't big enough for the size of tire they were running on. And so it would end up looking like the front and rear of the fender was too close to the tire, where another part, the midsection of the fender, was too far away. Getting that to line up so that it's all concentric and not diverging at weird angles, that's not an easy thing to do. They also made sure to give the bike plenty of clearance below those fenders, even though they were running 28 millimeter tires. And I don't know about you, but around these parts, 28th, the new 25. Our roads are in rough shape around here. So even though people may still like racing on 23s here and there, the bigger tire is where it's at. We know the rolling resistance isn't what it used to be because of better casings and better tires. And so seeing somebody pay attention to that. And then there were little things like they crafted their own hardware for the fenders to attach that instead of these little stamped steel brackets with screws that, you know, are no better than what come with the reflectors on most production bikes. Every little detail about that bike was extremely well thought through. It was such a well-done package. I was deeply impressed by it.
Well, a lot of what you said, you know, that's the practice here, the wider tires, the fenders that meet up correctly with the shape of the wheel. It's just interesting hearing you talk about those are the details that you look for when you go to put a ribbon on a bike. We know that the most important announcement that Don Walker makes every year is where he's going next year. And so where are we going next year?
Dallas.
What do you think about that? Back to Texas? Because I think the show started, it'll be 16 years back. Wasn't it in Austin for its first year? A million years
first
ago?
First year might have been Austin. It was there in 2011, I want to say, was Austin. I don't have any ability to speak to Dallas. It's a big community. It's a relatively simple drive for people in a bunch of other communities like Austin, Houston, New Orleans, The Little Rock's not that bad. So there is some ability to draw people from other areas. That's always one of the concerns for where Don locates the show. You want to make sure you can draw in a big population. I'm told that returning to Austin, which was something that an awful lot of people, including me, wanted. I had a fantastic time last time we were in Austin. Neat, neat town, lots of street food. But I'm told that Austin was just prohibitively expensive. And while attendees of the show might not mind spending $150 a night on a hotel, there are certainly exhibitors for whom that's a real challenge. And so to make sure that the builders are happy, Don has to weigh their needs versus how expensive a given market is.
I totally get that some things make it prohibitive. And if the cost of a hotel room is outrageous, it's expensive to go to the show to begin with as an exhibitor, let alone to pay a fortune for a hotel and then meals. So, you know, I'm glad he takes that into consideration.
Yeah. You know, people aren't always certain what Don's priorities are. He can make decisions that, on the face of it, don't always make sense to everyone else. But he's been doing this a long time. He's successful at it at this point. You know, 15 years is a pretty reasonable run, I would say.
Yep.
And he really does listen to what the builders need. You know, when someone gets upset about a drayage charge that's as big as their hotel bill, well, you know, you gotta think about that.
That's right. That's right. Well, as always, it's been a delightful conversation. Thank you for helping me wrap up NABS. We've been talking with Patrick Brady. If you do not know his work, all you have to do is type in Red Kite Prayer. How's your podcast going, by the way?
Things are good.
Well, yeah, go ahead and plug
it. It's really enjoyable. And, well, actually, what I would rather plug, given that we've just been talking about NABS, is I am in the process of finishing up a series of posts in which I explain the how and the why of how each bike came to be a winner and what the other finalists were and
Perfect.
Why those were finalists.
Well, so, we'll make sure we post that to our stuff and send them your way.
Yeah, that'd be terrific.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with me. I hope the season goes well for you and we will catch up again soon.
That'd be great, Diane.
Alrighty.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Patrick Brady joined me from his Red Kite Prayer desk in California. If you're interested in the blow-by-blow decisions from NABS 2019, you can log on to redkiteprayer.com and click the Best in Show Judging from the March 26th entry. So let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Molly Herford about sleep. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Do you get enough sleep? How about the quality of your sleep? Researchers tell us that lack of sleep can cause a lot of issues, from physical illness to poor athletic performance. Molly Herford is here to tell us more. Hey, Molly, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's great to talk with you again. Spring is almost really here.
Almost, kind of, sort of. Great to be back.
Well, you know, you wrote an article that caught my attention this week. In fact, we're talking on the 29th, and it actually came out today, Why Sleep is Critical for Runners, and knowing that it's critical for all athletes. And so we're going to talk about it. You couch it in terms of cyclists, but who cares? You say, and I will quote you, currently up to 45% of Americans reported poor or insufficient sleep affecting their daily activities at least once in the past 7 days, and most are getting less than 7 hours of sleep per night. Tell us some of the consequences of too little sleep.
Yeah, I mean, studies have shown that a decrease in sleep can cause a huge decrease in your aerobic performance, up estimated 10 to 30%. I mean, if you think about that in terms of a 10K run or something, that's minutes. And then the other thing, especially for cyclists, is it really lowers your reflexes and your, you know, mental processing. Low sleep has even been compared to the same kind of like effect that you'd have being drunk. So So if you think about that, that can be so dangerous on a technical mountain bike trail, on a busy road. That's scary.
It is scary. It's not like mountain biking isn't dangerous enough, right?
Exactly.
Was there anything in the study that you read or the studies that you've looked at about restless sleep, not just not getting enough sleep, but poor sleep?
From what I've seen, any sleep is going to be better than no sleep. But yeah, restless sleep definitely has a lot of the same negative impacts. And there are so many little ways that we can make our sleep much more effective. And honestly, the one thing I keep coming back to is if you've tried everything and you're still not having any luck, it's so worth seeing a sleep expert. I mean, we have no problem as cyclists seeing a physical therapist, seeing a chiropractor, seeing, you know, a massage therapist, a nutritionist. Why are we not thinking about the thing that takes up a third of our lives?
Wow, what an interesting thought. It never even occurred to me. But of course, I actually have a friend who used to do sleep studies at the Cleveland Clinic.
Yeah.
So I know it's really, really important. You know, research has always shown we need between, what, 7 and 9 hours of sleep a night. And I know people say all the time, I have students who say to me, oh, I get by fine on 4 hours of sleep. How does research actually know that 7 to 9 hours is the correct amount for most of us?
Oh my gosh. I mean, just thousands and thousands of studies. And here's the thing. Yeah, there's so many people that say, oh yeah, I get by on 4 hours of sleep per night. I've heard that in so many interviews. And then if you listen to an interview with the person, maybe like 2 or 3 years later, they almost inevitably are like, I really thought I was getting by on that 4 hours of sleep per night. And, you know, then I suddenly realized that I was not functioning. I wasn't a happy person. Things were not going great. So I think we kind of lie to ourselves and say we can get by on that 4 hours when really we can't, and we're kind of just treading water. And I mean, really think about it. Like, what would happen if that person did get 7 hours of sleep? You know, I don't think their performance would decrease.
No, right, right. One would hope. And one would hope unless they sleepwalk through the day. So yeah. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Molly Herford. Her new article is about why sleep is critical for athletes, runners, cyclists. We know that. We know who they are. They're us. Let's run through a few of your suggestions for people. Your first one is prioritizing sleep. What does that mean?
So I'll maybe start with sort of an anecdote, is that I have a lot of really good friends who now have kids. And, you know, for a lot of them, they have kind of two choices. They can get 4 hours of sleep and get a workout in, or they can get, you know, that 6 or 7 hours of sleep and not get a workout in. I think, honestly, prioritizing that sleep is just so much more important. You know, you might just be in a cycle of life where getting in that longer bike ride isn't realistic for you, you know, and putting that priority as getting sleep is just going to be so much healthier for you overall, especially if you're listening to this show. You know, you're
right.
Probably a pretty avid cyclist. You're not, you know, someone who is like, oh, good, I was only getting 9 hours, but I'm going to get 11 instead.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we don't hear that too often. Let's talk about the next one, which is workout rhythm. What is that?
So I love this one because I know, you know, a ton of people are great at working out in the early morning. I am personally not one of those people. Some people are great at working out at night. There's a lot of people who work out at night and then can't fall asleep for hours on end. And they don't really put two and two together. But, you know, exercise has a lot of different hormonal impacts on our bodies. So for some people, you know, that evening workout might make it really hard to get to sleep. For some people, that evening workout might make it really easy to fall asleep. So really just paying attention to your own personal rhythms, not just going with, you know, what your friends are doing. And, you know, you might need to shift your schedule around to make more room for the workout where it's going to give you the best rest and get you to sleep the fastest.
Yeah, great advice. Great advice. So the next one I thought was very interesting because a few years ago, we never would have thought we needed to do this, and it's turn off your phone.
Yes. Oh, I know. So annoying. So easy and so hard, especially, you know, I'll admit for my generation and, you know, most of us now have our phones or our alarms, but really the best thing you can do is put it in another room, get off it, you know, at least an hour before bed. If you have your alarm in the other room, you have to get up to turn it off. You are so much less likely to hit the snooze button in the morning too. So has that side benefit.
But that's true. What about music? Do they say watching TV or reading a book or music is okay?
Reading a book is great. Music, totally fine. TV, you've got to watch that blue light. I've got those dorky yellow tinted blue light blocking glasses that I occasionally remember to put on. But really, you're better off reading an actual shocking, I know, paper book.
That's what I do. So it's not shocking to me. I don't like reading on the, I mean, I'm in front of a computer all the time. So it's like, let me have a real book.
Yep.
The next piece of advice won't work well if you're afraid of the dark, which I'm hoping most of us as adults are not. But, you know, there are some people who insist on sleeping with the light on, but it is about room temperature and the amount of light in the room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the best room temperature shown in a bunch of different studies is right around that 65 degrees Fahrenheit. So about the temperature that makes you really cold if you're, you know, sitting at your desk is going to make you super cozy under your blankets. I know I'm one of those people that needs like 8 fans on me at night. I like it like 60 degrees. That's how I sleep best. So figuring out how low you can go temperature wise. And plus you save on your heating bill. So, you know, bonus. And then, yeah, dark. It's annoying, I know. But the darker you can make your room, you know, if you can cover up all of those little red and green glowing lights from all of our chargers, if you can get blackout curtains or blackout blinds. My goal in life is to one day be bougie enough to get one of those automatic blinds that actually goes up in the morning so I get sunlight coming in, but that has not happened yet.
Yeah, our automatic alarm is a robin. He sits right outside our window every morning. That's how we know it's spring around here, too. The next thing I would never have even thought about, and I also don't know exactly what it is, athlete recovery sleepwear, so new jammies?
Yeah, Under Armour makes this really cool stuff that they call the athlete recovery sleepwear. It returns infrared energy to your body, which apparently boosts localized blood flow, increases the amount of oxygen reaching your muscles. I've tried it. I like it. I find it very comfy. I cannot swear to you that my blood flow has increased, but I really like cool little stuff like that, especially, you know, if it's cozy and it happens to look good. I'm a cyclist. I love the latest gear and tech stuff.
So is it like compression?
No. Oh, geez. No one should ever sleep in compression. Let's just put that right out there. No, this is just very light, comfortable fabric.
Nice. So the last bit of advice is interesting, and it's about tracking sleep. And I know if you wear a Fitbit or one of those tracking items, it will track your heart rate during sleep. Does it track other stuff?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the wearables are going to track different things, like HRV is sort of one of my more interesting things, heart rate variability. So it can see the space between the beats, not just what your heart rate is. A lot of them are like, there's even movement trackers, which only really work if you're sleeping in a bed alone. They don't really work if you've got two of you in there.
Right.
Side note.
Or the dogs. Right.
Yeah, and the dog, the cat throws it all off. I really like those because sometimes you might think that you're getting really, really great sleep and wondering why you feel tired all the time. And it might turn out that you're tossing and turning like crazy and you just aren't actually aware of it. So, you know, knowledge is power. We have all this stuff at our disposal. Most cyclists probably have some kind of watch or app already on their phone that can track sleep that they just aren't using. So I think it's always worth giving it a shot, seeing what's up.
Right. Well, I always talk to my students about heart rate, you know, and how important taking it twice is when you wake up before you get out of bed and then 10 minutes later, you know, and people don't understand that variation is telling sometimes. The one thing you don't talk about is napping. Is there anything about napping? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it preferred? Is it not preferred?
Yeah, it's kind of a weirdly hotly debated topic because different people seem to respond to naps very differently. You know, I've talked to some people who, you know, if they nap after 3 p.m., they're completely going to be screwed trying to go to sleep later that night. They just cannot get to sleep. Some people have a great midday nap. I know, you know, the few times I've worked in an office in my life, you could usually find me around noon, like camped out under my desk, taking a, a 20-minute nap. So I think napping is another one of the things you have to experiment with. I mean, if you're only getting 4 hours of sleep a night because you have a, you know, new puppy or, you know, the kids aren't sleeping well or something, then by all means, go ahead and nap. Just pay attention to if it's affecting your ability to fall asleep and stay asleep later. Because obviously the nighttime sleep is much more important than that, you know, 20-minute nap that you're getting midday.
Right. Well, as always, you always have such great information. We either talk about clothes and now we're talking about sleep. I wonder what our next topic will be. So your book is coming out, your new book, May 7th, I saw.
Oh, yes. So Shred Girls, Lindsay's Joyride is out May 7th. I'm super excited. If you guys pre-order on Amazon and shoot me an email, I'm super easy to find on the internet, or DM me a copy of the receipt, I will send you a pack of Shred Girls stickers too. Ooh. So everyone should get on the pre-order.
All right. Well, as I said, always great to talk with you, Molly. Some great advice about sleep and getting more of it. Thanks so much for talking with me. Have a wonderful spring.
Oh, you too.
Take care. Molly Herford and her husband are the authors of the Outdoor Edit blog. Molly also writes for Bicycling Magazine, and her newest book, Shred Girls, Lindsay's Joyride, will be out on May 7th. If you're interested in Molly's sleep article, log on to underarmorsblog.mapmyride.com and click on the sleep entry. So we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Emily and David Lafferty from Cycles Chinook. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. As the longtime stoker behind a great captain, I can tell you that the way the bike under you feels and moves can make or break your love of tandeming. And once you know that feeling of a flawless machine, you just want to keep on riding. Emily and David Lafferty figured all of that out and then decided they'd just build their own. When others saw it, a new business was started. Hello, Emily and David. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
It's my pleasure. So I'm a stoker. Emily, I know you're the stoker. I'm really excited to be able to talk about your work and your thoughts about tandeming, because we all have our little tandem stories. Can we get some background first?
Sure.
Emily, tell me about yourself, where you grew up, and how you got into cycling.
Sure. So I grew up in Hillsborough, New Hampshire, which is it's kind of tucked away on the western side of the state. It's a little bit hilly and it's a little bit rural. So essentially, you know, I grew up in a small town in New England, and I grew up riding a bike, as most kids do. I had a tricycle and a big wheel, and, you know, I'd kind of ride around town and ride to school. And then I stopped for a number of years. And when I started college, that's when I started riding again. I'm just kind of casually riding around. And I went to school up in the mountains. And I just really enjoyed riding in the mountains, going up and down the hills. I found it to be challenging and kind of exhilarating and a lot of fun. And after school, I moved to Boston. And that's when I met David. And David, as he'll kind of go into, his cycling kind of started in the city. So we were kind of, you know, city mouse, country mouse. our love for cycling varied quite a bit, because he kind of, you know, started out zooming through traffic and, you know, getting around town. And my love was being out in rural spaces and hills. Essentially, we'd get together, you know, every weekend and do these long rides. And that was, I think, kind of where we started to really fall in love with cycling and each other.
Nice. All right. Well, I guess I can't ask you guys about did you have a really cool How I Met Her story? Because you just told that story. So unless you have something else to say, David.
There's a little more to it. I'll give you a little bit of my cycling background.
Okay, good. I'd like that.
Because it leads into the How I Met Her story. Mm-hmm. So I didn't start cycling much until college. I just used a bike to get around town and get around the city of Boston. But I, at the same time, started fixing up junk bikes because my first bike was too small for me. So I got rid of that, got another one that was stolen, then bought a junk bike, and then had another one, and then got into kind of police auction and dumpster dive bikes that I would fix up for myself or for other people. But also going for rides and kind of appreciating that you could get around the city of Boston way faster by bike than by the T or by car. So shortly after college, I think I was still continuing this police auction and Craigslist bicycle buying and selling experience. And I had a set of pedals that struck the interest of a young lady on Craigslist. A set of horrifically cheap used SPDs. And I'll let Emily fill in the rest.
Oh, yeah. So I had just barely bought my first road bike, which did not come with pedals. So I was scouring Craigslist for a very cheap pair of pedals. And I had contacted David, and he met me in town, and he sold me the pedals. And well, there was kind of like this brief discussion of whether or not they would be compatible with my shoes. So he came up and he found my shoes, and he looked in the trunk of my car, and there I had all like this outdoor equipment. I had a snowboard and rock climbing gear and a bike, and because I had a tiny apartment, and the only place I could keep all my stuff was in my Dodge Neon. So I think he was like, who is this person? What does she do on the weekend? So we ended up just kind of staying in touch that way, I think, for maybe several months. It was winter in New England. So we kind of, you know, talked about cycling. And then as soon as spring hit, then we started getting together for bike rides. But, you know, we joke around that we met through Craigslist.
Which is one of those, well, do I trust him? Do I trust her? You know, that's pretty cool. How long ago was that?
That was 10 years ago.
Wow. No. Oh. We've been married for almost 10 years, David.
Oh, my gosh.
We met in 2006. So
that was 13 years ago.
Almost 13 years ago. Yeah.
Doesn't feel like that long.
Yeah, well, there you have it. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Emily and David Lafferty. They own Cycles Chinook. I want to get that right because we don't put the Chinook in front of the cycles. So I had a question about David's work, which is you're actually an engineer, mechanical engineer. You design bikes. What? How'd you get into designing bikes? I mean, I understand it from my end because that's what my husband does, but how did you get into that? And did you work with anybody else? Did you always just do this on your own?
That's an interesting question, Diane. So while I was trying to figure out what our next bikes would be, I learned over the years more and more about geometry and stuff like that, to the point where every time we felt like we needed a new bike, I would kind of sort out the exact stack reach, front center, trail, and all that stuff of this bike, and then figure out which off-the-shelf bike exactly met those specifications, so that rather than go and buy a custom bike, we could build up from a frame whatever bike we needed. And turned out that kind of my suspicions there were working out pretty well. And then transitioning a little bit forward beyond the geometry thing, we knew we needed a new tandem. We'd been riding a Trek T200 steel frame tandem for a while, and we wanted something that was faster and lighter and had better brakes and fit us better. And I'm trying to think, we had a whole laundry list of things, and we found that the most economical way for us to get that dream bike of ours was to build it ourselves.
Well, it's economical unless it's got a time lag somewhere in there. You know, and then you lose that whatever season it is that you're not riding it. But I understand. Yeah. So you decided to make your own tandem. How long ago was that?
That was 2017 by the time we actually got our bike complete.
So is it a titanium bike?
Mm-hmm. It's a titanium tandem with a telescoping rear seat post, so our 4-year-old daughter can fit the back. Has clearance for about 2.2-inch tires for riding on gravel.
Nice. So you guys still live on the East Coast?
We do. Yep. We're in New Hampshire, southern New Hampshire.
Oh, it's pretty up there. Very pretty up there. So I had a question about why you decided on titanium. Why did that become your metal of choice?
There are lots of good materials out there. Titanium has a few kind of small advantages for us over carbon fiber or steel or aluminum. And it's kind of the intersection of its highlights that stand out. So, you know, you can build a bike that's or tandem that's adequately stiff out of all those materials. And you can build one that's adequately light out of 3 out of 4 of those. And you can build one that's pretty durable out of 2 out of 4 of those materials. And the one that's left after saying I want it to be light and stiff and durable is titanium.
Okay, that makes sense. Are you happy with the ride quality? Clearly you are.
Oh, love it. Love it.
Okay. Let's talk a little. All right, Emily, I have a question for you.
Sure.
He's designing all these tandems. What are you doing?
Sure. So my background is business. I went to school for business. So I have 2 degrees, one in business management, and then also my MBA. I've worked in finance, business development, and consulting, kind of more on like the leadership side. So essentially my end is the business end. So I kind of handle the accounting and marketing efforts. You know, I'm also a stay-at-home mom. So having a home business and working together with my husband kind of helps keep everything central around our home. I can kind of work part-time and focus on things when they become important and relevant, but also spend a lot of time with my daughter. So it's a wonderful balance for us.
It sounds like it. Sounds like it. New Hampshire's a pretty state, too. It's not terribly crowded where you are, I take it.
No, I mean, we're definitely in the more developed part of the state. We're in the southern seacoast area.
Nice.
The seacoast itself is just beautiful for riding. It's not as hilly as the mountains, but we're still only an hour and a half away from the mountains and lakes and, you know, various scenic places in the state. So it gives us a lot of variety without having to travel a whole lot. You know, we have some friends and family that live out in California, and we've always been so attracted to their weather. And we have a cousin out in Santa Cruz, and, you know, he's just a couple hours away from the mountains and right by the ocean. But I feel like we have a little bit of all those things, but they're a little bit closer. So it makes it a bit more accessible, especially with a small child.
Yeah. And California, well, never mind. Fires, floods, you know, earthquakes. Yeah, you know, you're a little safer on the East Coast. Maybe. Who knows? Let's talk a little bit about Cycle Chinook. It wasn't always called that. It was called Granite. Is that right?
Correct. Granite Tandem Design.
So if I'm not mistaken, is New Hampshire the Granite State?
We are the Granite State.
Right. So clearly that was the reason. But so why did you change it to Cycle Chinook?
Yeah. So we, when we started our business, we kind of said, you know, essentially we had built ourselves a bike and there was a lot of interest around it. And we had been riding a tandem for a long time and nobody really seemed to care about our bike at all. Our old track was a lot of fun. We enjoyed it for many years, but nobody really cared. And our new bike, it was drawing enough interest where we said, you know what, like if somebody wants to have the experience that we had, where you get to discover what it is that you want to do on a bike and then have a bike built for that adventure that you have in mind, we could provide that to other people. So our initial thing was like, all we need is a business card. But for a business card, you have to come up with a name. So we decided on Granite because it, you know, it showcased our home state or my home state where we live now. And it was pretty simple. Once we got kind of more into the business end side of things and we tried to trademark the name, we ended up with some trademarking issues because It is so generic. There's a lot of other bikes with model names centered around Granite. So we decided to kind of start exploring the brand a little bit further. And since we've had success beyond what we were initially thinking as well, we ended up working together with a really cool marketing company based out in Colorado. And they helped us kind of discover a new name and dive a little bit deeper into like who we are and what we enjoy. And we came up with Cycles Chinook.
Yeah, so Chinook is the state dog of New Hampshire. It was bred specifically for Arctic expedition for endurance, speed, stamina, and still having good manners.
Yeah. It's a mix between a husky and a farm dog.
It sounds good to me. Do you have one?
We do not have one. We have a Bernese mountain dog.
Do you really? Oh, have fun.
Yeah, and she is lovely. Not so adventurous, though. Very much into just eating and napping, which also holds a place in my heart.
Well, you're a cyclist, so the eating part I certainly get. So, David, I want to ask you a little bit about your idea on designing tandems. What makes a cycle Chinook tandem perhaps different from, and I don't want to use a production tandem, but maybe a Santana. And I'm using Santana because that's sort of a, when people think about tandems in the marketplace, Santana's got a big name.
Sure. We differentiate ourselves from, I would say, Santana, Commotion, Calfee, Seven, Da Vinci, a handful of different ways and different in comparison to each of them. Compared to Santana specifically, we use kind of fewer proprietary parts and we try to be more forward with what the frame geometry is and be open to whatever kind of ride quality or handling our customers want. We don't push them too far down any direction they don't want to go, as far as mostly handling and comfort. We like to offer like as much flexibility as people want in their bikes. And then versus like Commotion, for example, we do everything's fully custom right now. Plus we're working with titanium that they don't offer.
Right.
And then the other thing that we're doing, I think, a lot different from the builders whose shoulders we're standing on is that we have a different take on tire clearance. And it's a really simple thing, but I've been following this trend of wider tires on road bikes basically since I started cycling. And the tandem field has not picked up on that and really hasn't picked up on the fact that on a tandem with twice the weight, you need tires that have twice the volume. It seems almost too simple, but in all of our testing of things where Emily at 100 pounds, me at 170 pounds, and then the tandem fully loaded or not, playing around with different tire sizes, we've come up with our own formula for figuring out how big and what pressure tires should run. That's very much weight and surface dependent.
Right.
And we impose our beliefs on our customers, and it turns out everybody said, wow, these tires feel great.
I totally get that. Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with David and Emily Lafferty. They have Cycle Chinook. They build tandems, titanium tandems. And I had a question about forks, because one of the issues, you can build your rear triangle pretty much as wide as you want, use disc brakes. Whose forks are you using? Because you need a pretty hefty fork on a tandem. And are you building these forks yourself?
We are building these forks ourselves.
Oh, very cool.
So our personal bike has a Rodriguez fork on it. And our first customer's bike has a Whiskey fork on it. And that was the limit as far as we went with other people's forks before we realized that we had to make our own. Everybody was coming to us saying, I want throw axles and I want disc brakes. And if you want a tandem rated fork that'll take a 203 millimeter rotor and throw axles, the choices on the market are nil.
Right. Slim and zero. Right. Pretty much.
Especially if you want it to be short enough for a road position. We very quickly learned we needed to make our own forks. So we learned everything we need to know and added that to our catalog.
Who's your primary client? Where are they finding you?
It's largely word of mouth. Our customers tend to have met other customers. Basically, we find, or a couple of people have found us, and then now their friends are riding or ordering bikes from us, or the people that they rode with, or the people they bumped into on a ride. And it's just going through word of mouth. Our clientele, it's a mix. We have a handful of blind athletes riding our bikes. We built a bike for the Race Across America team C2C, the first all-blind Stoker team to complete Race Across America. And after that race, one of the team mechanics and two of the other racers on the team have purchased bikes from us.
Yeah, nice how that goes, huh? How long is the wait for a bike?
we're running about 13 weeks right now from deposit to delivery. For the most part, we can start working with people right away in like the first couple of emails or interviews or what have you.
Is that how you do it for the most part?
Yeah, yeah. We do a lot of emailing or text messaging or Facebook Messenger, whatever kind of communication method people are into.
How are you handling the fitting?
A lot of our folks come to us that have already had a professional fit.
Ah.
Yeah, fitting is admittedly not in our expertise. We can tweak fits a little bit, but it's a lot simpler if people go to whoever the best fitter in their area is, and we work with that professional fit sheet.
So what do you guys do when you're not making bikes?
Well, we try to still ride ours.
Okay.
I also run as well, so we kind of have a couple different, you know, athletic endeavors that we usually take on during the year. And then we have a 4.5-year-old daughter who, you know, usually keeps us pretty busy as well.
Right. Everybody thinks when you own a bike business that you get to ride a lot. It's such a joke.
I don't know why they think that.
Well, how can my listeners find out more about your company? And do you also offer, do you have a bike that people could come and test ride?
If people are in southern New Hampshire, they can absolutely take our bike for a spin. With the telescoping rear seat post, it can accommodate a pretty wide range of riders. It's not going to be perfect fit for everyone, but we can at least get the seat and handlebars about right.
Yeah, we always welcome people to our home in Kensington, New Hampshire. You can find us online at cycleschinook.com, and we're also on Facebook. So those are some ways that we can be found online. We're hoping in the future that we'll be able to get some demo bikes out to shops in various places in the country. So
nice.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you have a wonderful 2019 selling season. It's finally opening up here in Cleveland. We're supposed to actually have weather above 38 degrees today. I don't know about you guys. I think you guys are warmer than we are.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually have some temps in the 50s and 60s coming. So hopefully we'll be out riding at some point again.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me. Good luck. We've been talking with David and Emily Lafferty. They own Cycle Chinook at cyclechinook.com tandems. Have a great day.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Emily and David Lafferty from Cycle Chinook join me from their offices in New Hampshire. If you're interested in their work, log on to cycleschinook.com. So that wraps up our show for the week. I hope you enjoyed my conversations with Patrick Brady from Red Kite Prayer, Molly Herford from The Outdoor Edit, and the proprietors of Cycle Chinook, Emily and David Lafferty. Join me next week when we talk once again with expert professional fitter Happy Friedman. He's got a lot of new stuff to share. We'll also finally catch up with world land speed record holder Denise Koronek. Yep, last time we spoke, she told us about her ride at the Bonneville Salt Flats that left her just shy of the women's record. Well, this time she not only smashed that record, she also smashed the men's. Thank you for listening. Remember that you can always follow the conversation on Facebook. You can send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. If you like the show, please log on to your favorite podcast app and rate it. Maybe even say something nice. So I hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.